Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Catholic Singles. Every day, hundreds of Catholic singles join CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love. Breadbox Media listeners get 20% off by using the promo code BREADBOX when they register. Come be our next success story at CatholicSingles.com. Looking for a way to build daily prayer discipline? Seen the rise in mindfulness meditation, but not sure if it is possible to meditate in a way that's consistent with your Catholic faith? Just looking for a way to breathe new life into your existing prayer routine? No matter what you're looking for, Hollow is here to help. Hollow is a Catholic prayer and meditation app that helps users deepen their relationship with God through audio-guided contemplative prayer sessions. From meditations on the daily gospel, to the rosary, to daily examines, Hollow has something for everyone. Hollow is the number one Catholic app in the U.S. It is free to download and has permanently free content, but you can also check out all of the premium sessions for 30 days, risk-free, by signing up at www.hollow.app/breadbox.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thank you so much for being with us. A couple of great hours coming up. Second hour, we've got Mark Brumley. This hour, we've got Jimmy Akin. And both hours, it's open forum, so you can ask them anything you like about Catholic faith, Catholic people, Catholic belief. You don't have to be Catholic. Open forum is for everybody. Especially when Jimmy's here, we're pretty liberal in the questions that we'll take. If you have questions of a more generally religious or philosophical nature, moral questions are certainly welcome, and even questions on life in general. Scientific questions, perhaps. Weird phenomena. Those are welcome as well. Our number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. And hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
You're the same Jimmy Akin that's the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book?
Yes.
Well, it's nice to see you again, Jimmy Akin.
Likewise, Cy Kellett.
I like the double name thing. I don't know. Might be a little time consuming. And you're also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Sure.
I can't figure out, is dark matter a real thing or not?
Well, most scientists think dark matter is a real thing.
Yeah.
And if you listen to last Friday's episode of Mysterious World, I tell you why they think dark matter is a real thing.
It's a weight problem, basically.
So to speak, a gravity problem.
Oh, well. Okay.
As well as dark energy.
That's what I'm going to call it. This is a gravity problem that I have around my midriff here. It's not a weight problem.
Well.
It's a gravity problem.
When you have mass in a gravitational field, you get weight. So.
Yeah. All right.
But tomorrow's episode is on private revelations and how they're evaluated.
Oh, thank goodness. This is one of the things people ask so many questions about. Mm-hmm. This will be nice to have What'll you do? Maybe an hour on it, 50 minutes,
yeah.
An hour, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, these are typically about an hour.
We can refer people to. Okay, I'm going to make a prediction.
What's your prediction?
At some point, you will mention Joseph Ratzinger.
I don't recall if that actually happens.
Oh,
I would have. Primarily, I go through the document that the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith released back in the 1970s for bishops.
Oh, okay.
And that was before his term on the CDF.
I always think of the thing that he wrote when they released the
Message
the Third
of Fatima.
Secret.
Yeah. I may quote that in it.
Yeah.
I do quote Benedict the 14th, though.
Well,
who
all
wrote?
Right. I'm going to call that a win for me.
The classic treatises on this.
It's only a few centuries off, so I'm going to go with that. 888-318-7884, the number. Jimmy is the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, also the author of many other things, including The Drama of Salvation, The Fathers Know Best, that's about the Church Fathers, and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Let's go to the phones. Let's start with Anne Marie in San Antonio, Texas, listening on the Guadalupe Radio Network. I got to go to the right button, though, Anne Marie. Hang on. Hi, Anne Marie. You got a question for Jimmy?
Hi. Yes. Can you hear me?
We can, yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Happy to.
So I am a nurse, and recently I overheard one of my patient's family members talking to another family member about Jesus. And so she was saying that he most likely would not have not been married because it was so countercultural for that time. Like during that time, Jewish men were always married. And if he wasn't married, he would have had to make some claim in the Bible or somewhere about something about not being married.
Mm-hmm.
I know Jesus was not a very cultural, he was a very countercultural person, and he didn't do things that were with like society's norms, but I didn't really know how to like defend.
Okay. So there are, just based on the two arguments that you mentioned your family member making, the first one is it's not as countercultural for as people think. Now, it's true. In Jesus' day, most people were married, just like most people today are married. But you also had people who were not married. In fact, you had people who were not married in first century Palestinian Judaism for religious reasons. There were people who, for example, many members of the Essene movement within first century Palestinian Judaism were not married. They practiced celibacy for religious reasons. And there are others as well. We know of various ascetics who devoted themselves to God and did not marry. For example, there was one in the mid-first century we know about named Banias or Banus, and he was an associate of the Jewish historian Josephus. So we know that there were Jewish men who refrained from marriage for religious reasons living in this very time and place. Secondly, regarding the statement that Jesus would have had to say something about this in the New Testament, well, he didn't write any of the New Testament, so he's not the one who would say something about it. But something that you could find other people who wrote the New Testament talking about. They might take note of the fact that Jesus was unmarried, and in fact, they did. If you look at Matthew chapter 19 and the parallel in Mark chapter 10, but especially Matthew chapter 19, Jesus is talking about divorce and remarriage, and he makes the point that marriage is for life, and just because you get a divorce doesn't mean you're free to remarry. And the disciples somewhat skeptically say, well, or cynically say, well, if that's the case, it'd be better not to get married. And Jesus then takes that as an opportunity to say, well, there are people who are made, who are born eunuchs, and there are people who are made eunuchs by men, and then there are those who are eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. And he says this teaching isn't for everyone, but let him who accept it can. So a eunuch, now, classically, a eunuch is a male who has been surgically altered so that he no longer is fertile. And eunuchs were used to, for in the ancient world, for example, to guard the harems of rulers, since they couldn't, you know, themselves engage in relations with members of the harem. And Jesus is using that a bit metaphorically here. He alludes to the fact that there are some people who are just born that way. They have a birth defect. And then there are other people who are made that way by men, such as to guard a harem. And then there are those who choose to be eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. And he says it's not for everybody, but he who can accept it should. And he thus holds up being a eunuch for the sake of the kingdom of heaven, i.e. being unmarried or celibate for religious reasons, as a spiritual ideal. And since the early Christians, including the disciples who were right there, viewed Jesus as the spiritual ideal, and he's articulating this teaching of celibacy as the spiritual ideal, we can very reasonably infer that he met it. The bizarre thing would be if Jesus is holding up celibacy as a religious ideal, and then he doesn't meet it himself.
Yeah.
You know, that, how is that consistent with him being the all-holy Son of God who's perfect? Also, we have abundant evidence elsewhere in the New Testament where you have the church referred to repeatedly by multiple different New Testament authors as the bride of Christ. I mean, Paul does that, John does that. And so so you have this widespread understanding of the church as the bride of Christ. And that's obviously a mystical, metaphorical bride, not a real one. But why would it have even come up if there was a literal flesh and blood Mrs. Jesus somewhere?
Right.
That wouldn't make any sense.
That's offensive.
If you had, okay, Salome, everybody knows Salome is the wife of Jesus. So let's start talking about his church as if it's the wife of Jesus.
Right.
Doesn't make any sense. So we actually have quite good evidence about this. If you'd like to read more, I actually have a resource to recommend for you. It's a little Kindle book that I published just a couple of months ago. It's on Amazon. It's called Was Jesus Married? The Startling Evidence That Would Surprise Millions, namely the millions who read the Da Vinci Code.
Oh, yeah.
It's just by Jimmy Akin. It's called Was Jesus Married? It's inexpensive. It's a quick read, and it goes through the ancient evidence.
Anne Marie, thank you very much. Appreciate the call. It's open forum today. Jimmy Akin here. Next hour, Mark Brumley will be here. And both hours, your calls are welcome. Whoever you are, you're welcome to call with your questions. 888-318-7884.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com. Catholic Answers Live is sponsored by Daily Catholic Wisdom. Go to CatholicWisdom.org and sign up for short daily reflections from brilliant, faithful Catholic minds. Literary giants, beloved saints, and relevant voices from today share insightful and inspiring snippets that you can read in less than a minute and reflect on throughout the day. Plus, enjoy exclusive discounts on popular Catholic books, talks, video content, and more. Join Catholics across the globe who start their day with Daily Catholic Wisdom. Sign up for free today at CatholicWisdom.org.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Listeners to Catholic Radio, I think, benefit most, at least initially, from what I call remedial catechesis. What Catholic Radio does is it becomes an echo chamber for the teaching authority of the Catholic Church. And what we're doing is teaching many things which have been neglected over the last 40, 50 years. If you listen to Catholic Radio, you know what the Catholic Church teaches.
Al Cresta thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Open forum both hours today on Catholic Answers Live. Your calls welcome, 888-318-7884. And if you haven't got them yet, Advent just days away now. Excuse me, Lent just days away. Well, Advent too, but it's a lot more days. But Lent just days away, and we've got this Catholic Answers 20 Answers Challenge going on for the Lent and Easter seasons. Basically, we offer you all 38 books in the series at 60% off and kind of challenge you. Do you want to read them through Lent and Easter season? I did it a few years ago, and it was way easier then because there's a lot more of them now. But you can get the whole set, 38 books in the 20 Answers series at 60% off. And if you're in the continental United States, they get shipped to you for free right now. Just go to shop.catholic.com, you know, find the banner, click the banner, get the 38 books, 60% off. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Some of those books authored by Jimmy Akin. I think the Old Testament, you're the author of the Old Testament, you're the author of the New Testament.
The 20 Answers books on them.
Okay, very important clarification, Jimmy. Jimmy, our guest, of course, today. Let's see who we've got next for Jimmy. You know what? Someone sent this question in and isn't able to call, and Marie asked that I get it to you. Jimmy mentioned that he felt that Pope Benedict might someday be canonized a saint. Can Jimmy explain his reasoning?
Yes. Yes, I can.
You obviously have not seen the movie The Two Popes.
No, I have not.
I watched some of that. Mm-hmm. Oh, my. They don't really like Pope Benedict, whoever made that movie.
Okay.
So based on that movie, no. Hmm. So we'll have to go by reality.
Okay.
So sum it up. Why would you say he's...
Well, a couple of reasons. One is that... So popes in I'm gonna say this both in a positive way and in a somewhat more cynical way.
Okay.
In a positive way, from a positive perspective, popes like to do things to promote the good of the church, and they do that in different ways in different ages. Put a little cynically, popes like to do things, they're human too, so they like to do things to show their greatness, just like political rulers in history. And in fact, frequently, for much of history, the Pope was a political ruler, namely of the Papal States.
Right.
And so, you know, rulers of various kinds try to do things that benefit their people that also show their own greatness. Like, you know, Herod the Great beautified the temple.
Yes.
Dramatically.
Right.
You know, there was even a saying among the early rabbis that if you haven't seen Herod's temple, you haven't seen a beautiful building. And so even though he was not a great guy, part of why he gets called the Great, because he was a very impactful ruler in Israel, right. And he was a great builder. He did lots of building projects. Well, popes do similar things. They try to do great things for the church. And to some extent, because they're human, they also are showing their own greatness a little bit. Mm-hmm. And certainly that's the case with some of the historic popes who were not always the best of people. I'm thinking Benedict the Ninth, for example. But how that works changes over the course of history. And in recent times, popes, either themselves or looking back on their recent predecessors, have been interested in holding popes up as examples of holiness, as saints, perhaps as messages to future other popes, like be like this guy.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Right.
And so that's one of the current notable things that you can observe about the papacy is for centuries we had long strings with no or very few papal saints, you know, where almost no pope was declared a saint. Mm. And then all of a sudden you hit the 20th century, late 19th and 20th century, wham, 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 bunches
saints
of papal
everywhere.
Saints.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's hard for me to say, well, that's because they're so much holier now than they were in the 1800s and 1700s,
yeah,
you know? Right. So it seems that there's an interest on the part of popes in having papal saints. Like I said, you know, perhaps to hold their recent predecessors up to future popes as examples. Well, Pope Benedict, apart from being a very holy man in and of himself and very humble, did something that was clearly an act of heroic virtue that set an example for future popes. And that is something that had not been done in hundreds of years. And that is, he walked away from the papacy for the good of the church.
Yeah.
And so that makes him an outstanding example to hold up, being willing to have the highest office in the church, and from one perspective, the highest office in the world.
Yeah.
And walk away from it for the good of the church, something that had not been done in hundreds and hundreds of years. So he was really bucking precedent to do that. And he could have stayed in office, and he could have, you know, continued to let his health decline and so forth and bear the weight of that office. But he judged it was better for the church to relinquish all of that power and authority and walk away and live a humble life in seclusion. Right. And that's an act of heroic virtue that is an outstanding example for future popes. And that's why I think there's very high likelihood that after he passes, future popes will look at him as a prime candidate for canonization.
John, I'm glad you were able to get the question to us. Thank you very much for the question. We go now to Matthew in Michigan, watching on YouTube Live. Matthew in Michigan, your question for Jimmy.
Yes. Hey, how's it going? I have a bioethical question here, and the question is, are married couples who are both open to life during sexual union required to abstain from sexual union if the woman is taking low-dose contraceptives to treat health illnesses such as ovarian cysts and endometriosis?
Okay. The church has not issued a teaching on this, so this is something that's been left up to the judgment of Catholic moral theologians, at least to this point. And I'm aware of something of a difference of opinion among different authors in this area, but what I can say is that the ones that I'm aware of who are really competent as moral theologians have not said that this is required. So the first point is, even though colloquially we call this set of hormones low-dose contraceptives because that's how they're often used, if you're using them for some other purpose, like to prevent ovarian cysts or treat ovarian cysts, you're not using them as contraceptives. So that's not what they are. They are an ovarian cyst treatment that happens to also inhibit the release of ova. And that means you're less likely to get pregnant when you are on these, because what you're taking them for is to treat your ovarian cyst, but you're just going to happen to ovulate less frequently while you're on them. But that's not why you're doing this. Mm-hmm. So it's not it's not a contraceptive act. It's a treatment act. It's a therapeutic act that happens to decrease fertility. Now, some people have said, well, maybe these pills will, or these hormones will also irritate the lining of the uterus and make it harder for an embryo to implant, and that would lead to a miscarriage, otherwise known as a spontaneous abortion. Well, okay, turns out there are some difficulties with that claim. One of them is, you know how whenever you see an ad for a drug, it'll list all these possible side effects?
It's so gross sometimes.
Yeah, and many of the time, much of the time, there is no documented evidence that it will do this. It's just, well, some other drug in this class maybe did this, so we're going to list it just to be legally safe. And so when the pill started coming on to the market back in the 60s, this was a speculation. But my understanding is recent studies have not backed up the idea that it has a notable effect of increasing miscarriages if a conception occurs, that this was largely speculation and it hasn't really been borne out by recent research.
Okay.
But let's suppose it did.
Yeah.
The alleged miscarriage induction potential of these hormones is something that is a tertiary effect. The primary effect, even when you're using them for contraceptive purposes, is not it causes miscarriages. That's what an IUD does, an intrauterine device. But this is not the primary effect of the birth control pill. The primary effect of the birth control pill is it stops the woman from ovulating.
Okay.
Then it has a secondary effect of it increases the mucosal thickness at the cervix and thus serves as a barrier preventing sperm from getting to the ovum if one happens to be released, which is very unlikely. And then tertiarily, maybe it has this irritation of the womb effect that could cause a miscarriage if the first two effects
didn't
prevent a conception from occurring. Well, if what you're concerned about is how many children are going to end up dying if you're taking versus not taking these hormones, there's a surprising answer to that, because if you're not on anything at all, you're likely to get pregnant, and at some point, unless you're deliberately trying to avoid it, you're going to get pregnant at some point. And it's thought that a third to a half of all pregnancies spontaneously miscarry. So you're likely to have quite a number of very early first trimester miscarriages that you may not even be aware of.
Yeah.
But then if you say, okay, so we're on this treatment for the ovarian cysts, and that reduces the number of ova released by a factor of 50, you're probably not going to get pregnant. There are going to be fewer children who die as a result of spontaneous miscarriage than would die if you were not on it.
Yeah.
And so consequently, it doesn't appear to me that there is a burden here to avoid it for that reason. And so I tend to go along with the moral theologians who would say that it is not required that couples who are taking oral hormones for the treatment of a condition need to abstain from relations during that time. But if you want expert opinion, contact the National Bioethics Center. Their website is ncbcenter.org, NCB for National Catholic Bioethics Center.org, and arrange a consultation with one of their ethicists.
Thanks, Andrew. I hope that that was helpful to you. Thank you very much for the question. Could you explain something to me? This is totally off topic, but what is the deal with, okay, all the symptoms, do not take this medication if you have high blood pressure, do not take this medication, blah, blah. And then there's always the last one, do not take this medication if you're allergic to this medication. Who needs that warning?
Is this an epistemic problem?
Like,
or?
I just don't understand why you would, like, it's like, to don't take poison if you can't handle poison. Like,
yeah, well, okay.
Is this just a legal thing, Jimmy Akin, or is there a scientific reason for saying
partly, this? There is partly a legal thing, but also partly people do dumb stuff. And sometimes
well,
they need
done
reminders.
Many myself, yeah, you know? That's okay, fair enough.
It's like if you're allergic to bee stings, maybe you don't want to be a beekeeper.
Yeah. Right. That's a good analogy. And I guess some people need to be told, if you're allergic to this medicine, don't take this medicine. June in Pittsburgh, Massachusetts, though. Oh, that's tricky, June. You live in Pittsburgh, Massachusetts. Whoops. Sorry, June. I pushed the wrong button. Give me a second here. It's all going to be all right. June in Pittsburgh, Massachusetts, your question for Jimmy Akin, please.
Yes. Thank you, Cy and Jimmy, for taking my call. I'm calling about the covenant in the Bible. Mm-hmm. We know pretty much what it consisted in the Old Testament, because God was constantly renewing his covenant with his people, and he gave them the Ten Commandments to live by. But I'm not clear what it is in the New Covenant, because Jesus never seemed to talk about it, except he mentioned it at the consecration of the wine at the Last Supper. Mm-hmm. And of the three accounts, two of them say, this is my blood of the covenant. And one of them says, this is my blood of the new covenant. Mm-hmm. So could you comment on that, Jimmy? Is the church our new covenant? Or are we still living under the old covenant or both?
We are, as Christians, we live under the new covenant. So in the Old Testament, now sometimes you'll hear it characterized as the old covenant as if there was just one. But actually, there was a series of covenants that were made in the Old Testament period. Pope Benedict, in retirement, actually wrote an article on covenants where he talks about this, and it's quite interesting. But I'll say more on the other side of the break.
Okay, hang on, June, if you can. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin. 888-318-7884, our number.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy. The latest episode of our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, is available right now. This week, we talk with Father Hugh Barber about whether Catholic devotion to relics is weird or pagan. Here's a little sample.
It's a legitimate form of expressing our devotion to those who are now in the glory of God and with whom we will also, God willing, share a glorious resurrection. So it's a way of expressing our faith in that. Now, this was probably the earliest, you might say, popular devotion of Christians, if you want to say popular. It was liturgical, though, too, is that the Christians first showed their devotion by observing the anniversaries of the departed, whether they were departed martyrs or just departed members of the family. And they went to their graves, and they had a little, they sometimes had mass, but they had a prayer service, and then they shared some food in honor of the departed.
You can hear the rest and get past episodes at CatholicAnswersFocus.com or subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Every Catholic has heard the challenge. How can you believe that? Don't you know the Bible says? It's a challenge we have to meet. If we can't reconcile apparent contradictions between Scripture and Catholic teaching, how can our faith survive? And if we can't answer our Protestant brothers and sisters, how will they ever come to embrace the fullness of the faith? In Meeting the Protestant Challenge, apologist Carlo Broussard gives you the knowledge and tools you need to answer 50 of the most common Bible-based objections to Catholicism. Catholicism. Be prepared to give an answer. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Challenge today by calling 844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Dr. David Anders here. Where is purgatory in the Bible? Why confess my sins to a priest?
Find out more tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on Call to Communion.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
So exciting. Eric's running the board. You're doing a great job, Eric. Getting trained on the new board.
Need more cowbell, though.
Yeah. More cowbell. Nick can have a day off every now and then? Is that what? Thank you for doing that. Appreciate that.
Also, we've got new software that they're using, and so all of our engineer guys are cross-training.
Yeah, we got new software because apparently the old software was so old that it won't work with
a modern computer.
Was it? It won't work with Windows 10, right? Mm-hmm. So once we upgraded from Windows 7 to Windows 10, we needed new software. So that's how we operate here, just to let you know. We are on the cutting edge. We've moved up to Windows 10. Eric, you're looking very confident in there, though. Give us a wall of sound, man. Make it a wall of sound. We went to the break. I'm sorry about this. June in Pittsburgh, Massachusetts. Sorry to keep you waiting, June. How rude of me. You were wanted to know if we live in under the old covenant, both covenants, or the new covenant.
So as I was saying before the break, there are actually multiple covenants that are described in the Old Testament. One of them is the covenant that God makes just after the flood. Another is covenant he makes with Abraham. Then there's the covenant at Sinai, which is the one associated with Moses. There's the covenant with David. And then Jeremiah prophesies that in coming times there will be a new covenant, which will not be like the other covenants. It's going to have different spiritual effects. It's going to be better. And that's what Jesus announced. And so that's why at the Last Supper he says, "This is the new covenant in my blood." Because that's what he's instituting. This is the new covenant that's been prophesied by Jeremiah. And consequently, we as Christians are participants in that new covenant, just like Jewish people were circumcised into the Abrahamic and later the Mosaic covenant. We're baptized into the new covenant, and that's what governs us as Christians. It includes not only the moral law that God gave to all mankind, it also includes specific rituals that also are part of the covenant, including the sacraments, baptism, confirmation, the Eucharist, and so on, which are our equivalents of the various Old Testament ceremonies like circumcision and Passover and things like that.
Mm-hmm. June, does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. Just one small question. In the New Testament, then, would the Beatitudes be part of the covenant also, and similar to the Ten Commandments in the Old?
The whole teaching of Christ is part of the New Covenant, yes.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much. I love that explanation.
No problem.
Thank you, June. It's very nice to hear a Massachusetts voice. Makes me feel like...
That's where you're from.
Yeah,
it's Massachusetts.
Right, and my family's from there, yep. That's just nice to hear June talking like that. Let's go to Andrew next in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on the Covenant Network. Andrew, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. And Si, thank you for taking my call, and thank you for all the work that you do. My question is really about a person, somebody that I kind of discovered early in my Catholic journey, Father Malachi Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote some books about, happenings within the church, about geopolitics, about his work as an exorcist. Jimmy, what is your view on Father Martin? Is he, do you regard him as an authentic, Catholic voice? Are these readings, beneficial? And Orthodox?
I would say, for people who may not be aware, Father Malachi Martin was a Jesuit who was active in the Jesuit order in the mid-20th century. And he then ended up being laicized, and he wrote a number of books, in some of which he was critical of various figures at the Vatican or general approaches that the Holy See was taking to various subjects. He made quite a number of sensationalistic claims, and he got a lot of sales for his books in certain circles. He was also a frequent guest on Art Bell's program, Coast to Coast AM, where he'd come on and talk about exorcism.
The great Art Bell.
Now, since you ask, I've read some of Martin's work, and I've studied some about Martin, and I cannot consider him a reliable source, so I can't recommend him. There are elements of truth in what he has to say, which is true of anybody. There are also, you know, and nobody's perfect. I don't expect an author to be perfect before I can recommend him. But Martin's pattern involved a kind of sensationalistic mindset where he went well beyond what the evidence could justify. For example, back in the 1960s, Pope Paul VI gave an audience where he talked about how it's as if the smoke of Satan has entered the church. Mm-hmm. And I, because this wasn't available in English, it was just a summary of it was only available in Italian, I took the initiative to get it translated. And I put it on my website. It's at jimmyakin.com. So you can read it for yourself. And it's clear that that the Pope was talking about how just bad stuff happens, you know, including in the church. And the 1960s, the late 1960s, it was a very volatile time. And there was a lot of confusion and crisis and so forth. And that's what he's referring to. But then Martin took this and claimed that there is some secret satanic ceremony by a cabal of Satanists working at the Vatican. And that's what he was secretly referring to, even though he didn't say anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this is this kind of sensationalistic mindset that deals with evidence in an unreliable way. And that's just one example. But there are enough problems. And like I said, you know, everybody has some stuff that's good in their writings. Everybody has some stuff that's bad. But Martin's is bad enough that I can't recommend it. It's just too unreliable from my perspective to recommend broadly.
Thank you, Andrew. Hope that was helpful to you. We're going to keep moving. Lots and lots of folks on the line. It's open forum today at Catholic Answers Live. Whether you're Catholic or not, you're welcome to call. And any question is welcome. Timothy in Missouri, listening on 1090 AM. You are next. Timothy, your question for Jimmy. No? No Timothy there, huh? All right. Maybe there's been a little shift. Let me go to...
I feel a disturbance in the force.
Did you feel that?
Like millions of voices crying out and not being able to get through on the call.
I hope he wasn't on Alderaan.
Dantooine. I'm pretty sure it was Dantooine.
Bad time to be on Alderaan. Okay, let's go to Marissa then in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tulsa, Oklahoma. Oh, come. I'm sorry, Marissa. This is not your fault. This is my fault. This is a little button trouble today. Hi, Marissa. You got a question for Jimmy?
I do. Okay, so I am a very, very baby Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I just started my journey about 3 months ago.
Oh, wonderful. Congratulations.
Yes, and I am on this huge Jesus high. I'm in apologetics and theology and trying to get into ministry and just trying to take it all in. I have like 3 pages of questions. I watch you guys a lot. I had to pick one, and this is a very random one out of my list, but it is one that has bothered me.
Okay, and you can always call back in the future with more questions.
Yes, I definitely will.
Good.
I definitely will. It's literally your guys' questions. It's for you guys. I have tattoos. Mm-hmm. I used to have piercings. I don't have them in anymore. Mm-hmm. And I also had breast augmentation
mm-hmm.
pre all of my Christian beliefs now.
Uh-huh.
Is it sinful to get body enhancements if your body is your temple? If I was to go, I don't want to get any more, but if I was to get more later on down the line, now that I am a born-again Christian, is it sinful? And also, I quit wearing makeup a few years ago because I used to dance, and I wore a lot of makeup, and I quit doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Is it considered sinful to be so made up all the time, where women are constantly wearing makeup and they have the boob jobs and they're wearing tight fitted clothing? I'm kind of trying to find my middle ground.
Sure, great.
And trying to figure out what is treating your body as a temple.
Okay. Thank you, Marissa.
So there is a balance to be had here. We don't need to make ourselves look miserable. That's not the pinnacle of spirituality. In fact, Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, if you're fasting, wash your face. You know, so yeah. Reasonable personal body care is just fine. You can make yourself look presentable to others. You don't need to deliberately make yourself look miserable, like never comb your hair or never wear makeup or anything like that. On the other hand, we shouldn't be obsessed with that stuff either. Peter talks about how what is even better than having fancy braided hair and stuff like that for women is having holiness and having this inner beauty that's more important than outer beauty. And so there is a middle ground here. You can do things to look good to other people, but you shouldn't be obsessed with it. And so that gets us to the practical question of, well, like, when does it become excessive? I would say that there are several potential pitfalls that one should watch out for. One of them is devoting more money to something than you have. You know, if you're like going into debt to do breast enhancement surgery or something like that, when you need to spend that money on something else, well, then it's excessive. Or spending more time on it than you have. Like if you're a woman and it takes you 2 hours to get made up every day, well, maybe there's a lighter beauty regimen that mm-hmm. you could do that wouldn't require a 12th of every day,
yeah.
you know, or a third of every waking day or whatever. It wouldn't be a third, but more than a 12th. And then the third is when you're actually harming your body's function. So, you know, if someone gets a tattoo, now I'll mention tattoos because in the Old Testament, Jewish people were forbidden to get tattoos because it was a pagan practice. Mm-hmm. That pagans would do. They would mark their bodies for the dead as part of the cult of ancestor worship. But that's the old law. That's the Jewish law. We as Christians are not bound by that. Putting ink in your skin is essentially a permanent form of makeup. But it doesn't, as long as you're doing it safely. And I have, just full disclosure, I have no tattoos and I have no plans on ever getting a tattoo. But to be honest about the principles here, it doesn't interfere with the function of your body to have a tattoo. And consequently, if you had tattoos, you know, it can be legitimate to get them as a form of body ornamentation. They need to be, you know, convey a morally healthy message. I mean, you don't want stuff glorifying the devil or whatever
right.
as a tattoo.
Yeah.
But, and if you're a guy, you don't want like super sexy women tattoos and things like that. But as long as what's in the tattoos is morally neutral or positive, it doesn't interfere with your body's functioning to have them. And so it's not a moral problem. Where I think it does become a problem is if it's being done unsafely, like with unsanitary needles that could give you a bloodborne disease, or when it's done in a way that interferes with body function, like getting multiple piercings for studs down your tongue so you can't talk properly.
Oh, yeah.
Well, then I think it crosses the line into mutilation
yeah.
and instead of simply ornamentation. So, Marissa, I agree with you. There is a balance here and there are lines, but we don't want to be overly scrupulous and think that any form of modification or any form of beauty enhancement is something as Christians that we need to avoid. And congratulations on your new walk with God. That is awesome.
Oh, and please do call again as the questions come up. You know, I'm sure you probably know this, but Tuesdays and Thursdays are generally open forum. You're welcome to call any day, but those Tuesdays and Thursdays are open to any question at all. It's a great privilege to get to talk with you, Marissa. However, we have to take a break. We get to take a break. It's have to take a break most of the time, but when Emily's here, it's we get to take a break. Hi, Emily.
Thank you, Si. Hi, it's good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Are you here to talk about the Catholic Answers Conference, the national conference?
Our national conference coming up in September, and I'm here to encourage everybody to come.
Okay, so why? Why should they come?
Because it's going to be amazing.
And it's more people every year. It keeps getting bigger and bigger. And I'm. How do you feel about the topic this year?
It's beautiful. So it's Who Do You Say That I Am? It's about Jesus. And it's really incredible because this is an opportunity to know our Lord better and love our Lord better. So we have beautiful informative talks, and then we also have talks that are going to really directly apply the knowledge about Jesus with the love that we should have towards him. And so it's going to be amazing, and it's just a beautiful opportunity for people to come together and really be refreshed in their faith.
Where is it?
It's going to be in La Jolla, the Hyatt Regency, and September 24th through 27th.
And they should get some kind of...
So just so folks know, La Jolla, or La Jolla to all of you non-native
Californians,
is here in the San Diego area.
Yes.
So you come to San Diego. The specific place in San Diego is La Jolla,
but you also
get to see the rest of the beautiful San Diego area.
At the Hyatt Regency La Jolla, the dates are...
September 24th through 27th.
Oh.
And we have an early bird special right now through June, $30 off. You just enter the code EARLY.
That's a very complicated code. So you go to CatholicAnswersConference.com, put in the promo code EARLY. You're going to get $30 off. And it's not a very expensive conference anyways. I mean, there's many. This is a three-day conference. Am I doing my math right? Three-day conference? And it's a very reasonable price, but $30 off. How can you resist? You got to come.
No, you can't. It's amazing.
And
we have a beautiful letter from someone who attended last year.
She's saying resistance is futile.
Yeah, you can't.
I've always thought of you as a kind of a Borg. You can't not come.
You can't not come.
It's like Sarah Lee.
Yeah, you can't not come. I just want to share this with everybody. This is from someone who attended last year. And she said, "What an amazing gift to the world you present to all of us. The knowledge, the faith, the spirit of joy, the humor exchange, and most importantly, the love of our Lord to share with all of us." And so,
isn't that beautiful?
Yeah, the takeaway from the conference really is incredible.
I feel in a certain way.
And so is the dine-in, actually.
The
dine-in, not just the takeaway, but also the dine-in.
It's
a really good meal.
He watches a lot of British TV, and that's what they say, takeaway. We say takeout, but they say takeaway. But it seems good. Like, it all sounds good to me, but I feel like we need something to put it over the top, like perhaps some square dancing. If you could just throw some square dancing in there, I feel like more people would come.
I don't know, Jimmy, can you help us out with that?
Oh, sure.
We're set.
Jimmy will be calling. Yeah. And you're going to give a talk, of course.
Yeah, of course.
All the guys here will. I heard Anthony Esalen is coming to give a talk.
Yeah.
The great Anthony Esalen. And who else have we got? We've got Bishop Strickland. From Texas.
Paul Gondreau. And we have Sister Mari Stella from the Sisters of Life.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, I'm extremely excited that on a personal level. And then Father Paul Check will be coming as well.
That old Father
Paul
Check.
In addition
to
all the Catholic Answer speakers. I mean, what more could you ask for?
And two afternoons of live Catholic Answers live radio, where you get to ask any question you want of Jimmy Akin. CatholicAnswersConference.com is the place to go. CatholicAnswersConference.com. Get $30 off right now if you put in the promo code EARLY and come square dance with us.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Every single day, I get to help our listeners of the Sunrise Morning Show wake up, find out what's going on in the church and the world, and then walk with them as we all seek to grow in knowledge and love of Jesus Christ and the Catholic faith. I mean, how could it get any better?
The Sunrise Morning Show with Anna Mitchell and Matt Swain. Tomorrow morning, 6 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. Next hour, Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, will be here. And it's open forum both hours. Up next is Timothy in Missouri, listening on 1090 AM. Timothy, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
So I grew up as a Protestant, but after listening to you guys on the radio, I've become interested in the Catholic Church. My question is, I know that during the Reformation, the selling of indulgences was a big, you know, issue between the Catholic, for the Catholic Church.
Yeah, they weren't actually sold. That's a distortion. What happened was you could do a variety of good works, like going on a pilgrimage or saying prayers or making a donation to a charitable cause, and you would receive an indulgence. But then that got picked up and translated into selling indulgences, as if making a donation was the same thing. But go ahead.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So my question was, does the Catholic Church still give indulgences, I guess? And does it have does that have anything to do with atonement money that's mentioned in Exodus 30?
Okay. So the Catholic Church still has indulgences, and what indulgences are is it's where the church intervenes to help a person by using, to the extent it can, the authority that God has given it to help lessen the temporal consequences that remain even after a sin is forgiven. Because even after a sin is forgiven, we can still have lingering effects from that sin. And to some extent, the church has been given the authority to address those, at least in this life. It can also do so by way of prayer for people who have passed on from this life. But at least in this life, you know, Jesus gave the church the power of the keys and the ability to bind and loose. And so that interacts with this area. The church still does have indulgences. The reason I hesitate is because there's a lot here theologically that I'm kind of trying to compress down to keep it in a radio format. Because I could give an hour-long lecture about all this. But the church does have them. In terms of Exodus 30, now I'd refresh my memory on, in Exodus 30, what is the money used in connection with? Is this the redemption of the firstborn, or is it something else?
Well, it just says that each person is required to give a half shekel or something for their atonement.
Okay. It doesn't really have any direct connection with indulgences. I mean, if I thought about it, maybe I could think of one, but indulgences today do not involve money at all. That was one of the things that happened after the Reformation was the church eliminated the charitable donation indulgences because it was being abused and people were misunderstanding it and so forth. So today, you cannot give a donation for an indulgence. As a result, you do other things, like go on a pilgrimage or say prayers or things like that. Or read scripture. That's another one. There's an indulgence for reading scripture. However, the concept of indulgences, even though it's not related to the atonement money in Exodus 30, it is based on principles, including principles that we see in the Old Testament, and even during the broader Exodus experience. One of the concepts that's involved in indulgences is God benefits one person for the sake of someone who has pleased him. So, for example, let's say you want to try to help out your departed loved one who may be in purgatory. Well, you could say, God, if I've pleased you, please help my relative in purgatory, and I'm going to do this indulgence here, and the church will apply that to the person in purgatory by way of prayer, because since the person's no longer living, the church doesn't have direct authority over that person. And this is similar to some of what we see, for example, in the Old Testament, where in the Exodus, at one point, God is so mad with the Israelites, he's gonna wipe them out. Now, that doesn't mean they're all going to go to hell, but they could suffer this temporal consequence in this life, namely physical death, because of their sins. But Moses intercedes for them. And because Moses has pleased God, God is gentler with the Israelites than he otherwise would have been. And that's one of the principles that's involved in indulgences, where God will treat someone more gently than he would have because someone else has pleased him and is interceding for that person. And we see something similar in the case of David, where even though Solomon has sinned against God and is going to rip the kingdom away from Solomon, he says, nevertheless, because of my servant David, I'm not going to rip away the entire kingdom, and I'm not going to do it during your day. So he mitigates the punishment of Solomon because David pleased him. We even see this principle in the New Testament. Cy Kellett, can you think of anyone who did something that pleased God that results in, I don't know, maybe all mankind being treated more gently than they would otherwise have happened?
I'm going to go with Jesus for the win.
Yeah, Jesus for the win.
Thank you.
In addition, we see it applied in other ways too. St. Paul in Romans talks about how the Jewish people of his day, even those who had rejected Christ, were still beloved on account of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who had pleased God. So they're treated, modern Jews that didn't even believe in Jesus, were being treated in a special way by God because these other people, the patriarchs, had pleased him. Timothy, if you'd like a more thorough discussion of all this than I can really offer here on the radio, I would suggest Googling my name, Jimmy Akin. That's A-K-I-N, just four letters, A-K-I-N, and a primer on indulgences, or a primer on indulgences. Also, myths about indulgences. So there's a couple of articles, you'll find them online, and I go through the biblical principles and talk about them, as well as the various myths that have grown up around indulgences, like they give you a license to sin, or they were sold, or things like that.
Timothy, thank you. Thanks to everybody else, too. Listen, if you're on the line, please stay on the line, because Mark Brumley will be here in just a few minutes, and we'll start taking more questions. If you haven't called, at least one line is going to be opening up here at the break, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book. You can get that at shop.catholic.com. You can also get it in bulk for just $3 a copy. Share it with other people, and you can find Jimmy at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very pleasant hour.
Yeah.
I like this. I like working with Jimmy Akin. We should do this more often. Can we? All right. Right back. More Open Forum.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by A few minutes each day can change your life during Lent. Ave Maria Press offers booklets for daily devotion, reflection, and more from such best-selling authors as Gary Zemak, Greg Kandra, Father Michael White, and Tom Corcoran, and so many more. Looking for Stations of the Cross booklets or books that are perfect for small groups? We have those too. Head over to AveMariaPress.com and use code LENT20 to get 20% off your order today. Looking for exceptional coffee delivered fresh to your door? We have the answer. Our friends at Grim Bean Coffee produce small-batch, artisan coffee using top-tier coffee beans. The coffee is roasted when you order, guaranteeing the freshest coffee possible. Check out Breadbox Roasts, a new line of Catholic-themed coffees available at www.grimbeancoffee.com/Redbox Media. Experience coffee like never before.